welcome you to the call today, having a hard conversation. My name is Rebecca Caldwell, and I'm Program Director of Integral Facilitator. We're hosting the call today and very interested in bringing a more integral perspective to difficult social and cultural issues that align people around points of view that sometimes are conflated and irresolvable. Our work includes working in culture, defining new ways to build competencies and expand our abilities as a facilitative leaders to bring more perspective to the table, to include more, and to be able to work with some of the challenges of the actual dynamics and shadow that sometimes exists in our groups, cultures, and communities today. Our understanding today from the number of registrations that we have is that people are joining the call from a number of different professional and practice communities, and this is really exciting to us because we think this is really one of the most timely skill sets that we could possibly focus on in the kind of complexity of our human issues today. And I'm really happy to have with us a fantastic teacher of just those skills, a masterful facilitator, mediator, a transmitted Zen teacher, and an author, Diane Musho-Hamilton. And Diane will be guiding us through a process today and able to answer some questions through the call. So I know that we're going to have a very rich and interesting discussion. I'll also point out that Diane has a current blog post which may have actually led you to the call, and focusing on ways of looking at the events in Ferguson, Missouri, and also bringing some questions to the way that we deliberate and discuss issues and events such as what's happened in Ferguson. So you might, if you haven't already seen it, we'll point you in that direction at the end of the call. So just in terms of format, so you can anticipate how we'll work together over the next hour, I'll be introducing Diane in just a moment, and we'll be in a number of discussions and flow through that, which will take most of the hour. And at the end of the hour, I'd be very happy to stay behind and invite anyone who's interested in hearing more about our programs in the Integral Facilitator Pathway to stay behind, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have and give you a quick overview. Basically, we are working to develop facilitative leaders, and our programs include a 3-day intensive, an introduction to a more integral approach to working with groups, and extend to a 9-month certificate program, which is competency-based. And I'd be happy to answer your questions, as I mentioned at the end of the call. We'll also be pointing you to some resources that may come up through the call, and I'll provide that information at the end of the call as well. And for anyone who might have to leave before the call is wrapped, you may already know that we'll be sending out an email with a link to the audio so that you don't miss anything. And, of course, we hope that you stay all the way through. So I'm really delighted to open the call and invite Diane to say hello. And as I'm just about to do that, I'd also like to introduce another faculty member from the Integral Facilitator Program, Rob McNamara, who himself is a performance coach extraordinaire, teacher, and also a member of the faculty team on Integral Facilitator. And Rob is also a teaching fellow at Harvard. So Rob has brings lots of insight into especially adult development that is helpful in these kinds of discussions. So Diane, you might want to fill in some more related to that as you go, but I'd love to introduce you now, and thanks everyone for being part of the call. Welcome, Di.
Hi, everybody, and thank you, Rebecca. Thank you for your gracious introduction, and thank you to everybody who's listening today or who's tuned in to take just 60 minutes out of your day to tune into, you know, the events in Ferguson and the national conversation that's going on around issues like race and the militarization of the police, for instance, everything that extends from this event of the shooting of an unarmed young black man, one of quite a few that have happened. And so it's important just to appreciate you for actually being willing to tune into the conversation and to kind of open your heart and minds to how you as a listener or as a facilitator or as a mediator might actually be able to position yourself in such a way to bring more clarity and more compassion perhaps to these conversations if you find yourself either in one informally or if you find yourself in one that you've been actually asked to support. So our purpose for this call is, first of all, just simply what we won't be talking as specifically about what's happening in Ferguson. We'll be talking more specifically about how you can participate in a conversation and how you can give it a structure. So I just want to make that distinction. We can talk about the actual events. I'll give a quick overview in a few minutes about what we know about what actually happened there, some of what's happening in culture, and then how the rest of us are affected as interested onlookers or people who've been involved in, you know, any of the many issues that are, you know, part of this particular event. But before we do that, what I'd like to do is present to you as an audience, first of all, and just kind of see who we are before we kind of tap into the actual content of the call. So I'm going to pose just a couple of questions, and what I would like is for you to just press one on your handheld so I can kind of convey to you what might be some of the orientations that are actually listening to what's happening today. So I'd like to ask, first of all, if you would press one on your handheld, if you would identify yourself as a person of color or as an ethnic minority in your community. Either one of those two labels would be great for me to see and hear. And thank you. And those of you who would identify yourself, let's see. Okay, good. And those of you who would identify yourselves as of European descent or would call yourself white. How many people on the phone? Please press one on your handheld. All right. So right now we've got about a 1-to-4 ratio, which is, that makes sense to me. I guess, Lauren, if you would clear everybody's raised hands, or Justin, and I would like to know one other thing, and that is how many of you would create another category besides what I just said? You know, I basically drew a pretty broad line. It's a very crude line. It doesn't always help us, but sometimes it does help. So I ask you to identify as a, okay, so we've got one person. Could you tell me, Sharona, what other category you're identifying as? Keeping in mind, these are fluid.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Middle Eastern.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. And let's see. How about Aaliyah? How about you? I can't hear Aaliyah. Aaliyah, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
I can now, please. Yeah. Another category besides person of color or white majority.
Yeah, because you're speaking of color or ethnicity, and there are other minorities.
Totally. So what other categories?
Yeah.
Other minorities? Other minorities? Okay, good. And
yeah, other kinds of minorities that are often targeted.
Yeah, indeed. But for this conversation, I'm specifically focusing on people who identify as a person of color or an ethnic minority for just the structure. Yeah,
okay.
Other minorities. We might bring some up a little bit later in the call because there are lots of dimensions to this conversation. Thank you. Adriana, do you have a suggestion for other categories?
Can you hear me, Diane?
I can.
I'm Hispanic, but I consider myself, I wouldn't put myself in the ethnic minority category because I was raised with a lot of privilege. So I do like to create a distinction about my ethnicity. Yeah.
Okay. All right, awesome. And one of the kinds of privileges, of course, that come up when we start having these complex social conversations is whether or not, I mean, class and race are always interacting in this country, as we know. So one of the
one of the things we might identify is whether we had a certain level of educational privilege, was it economic privilege, was it the privilege of feeling like a majority, even though the percentages of your population might have been smaller. Like, there's all different kinds of privileges, just to go back to what Aaliyah was saying. You know, so the subcategories, to some degree in this conversation, are very subtle, and there are many, many more subcategories. And I'm going to be using some very broad polarities to help us navigate through some of this content. So I'm going to take one more question from Evan. So go ahead, Evan. I mean, one more category.
Yeah, I have some Alaska Native heritage, which is important to me, but as with the last caller, have grown up essentially with privilege and mostly consider myself to be white and of European descent.
Yeah, fair enough. And you know, it's great that we feel some confusion too, because as we say, we're creating conceptual categories, but in reality, what are they really? And we all know that, you know, melanin in the skin is a category. And it doesn't really help us solve our social problems to create those categories. And yet we act out of a long, long history of prejudice based on where we came from in the world and how we look. So we know that that's true. And there are lots of other sorts of, categories that interact around the issue of race and ethnicity, including class, as I've already said. But we're going to navigate through some of that so we can make this all a little bit manageable. So another question I would like to ask everybody is, how many people on the call, and you can just raise your hands, and we'll need to erase the there are other categories of people identifying, but there are too many to call on. So now we're going to move to asking the question, how many people on the call feel that they, at one time or another, have experienced some form of prejudice, maybe race prejudice being the most obvious, but well, you were basically, based on something about your culture, you felt that you were either devalued, treated unfairly, or basically victimized by someone else's prejudice. Let me just see a show of hands of people who can identify with that experience. All right, so as we're looking, as I'm looking down the call, I would say right now I don't have the exact number, but it looks like maybe 35% had that experience. If I were to open that up and include an experience of gender bias, how many additional people would raise their hands? Just out of curiosity. Feel you've been the subject of gender bias. Religious bias? Okay, good. So at this point now, we're up in more of the sort of 65% range. And I'm going to ask one more question because I'm just curious if you would erase all the raised hands. How many people on the call feel that you have been guilty at one time or another of actually seeing people through a biased lens, maybe even treating them unfairly? Maybe that bias led to some sort of unethical action on your part. How many of you feel you've actually been the source of a particular kind of bias? Okay, well, let me ask one final question. Question, and then I'll make some general comments. The last question I would like to ask, just again to get a sense of who's on the call, if we could take down the raised hands, how many people on the call are in a position of either informally wanting to facilitate conversations about these kinds of explosive issues, or who actually do facilitate these kinds of conversations, mediators, facilitators, working on diversity issues or race relations? How many people feel that it's something that you want to be able to do? Okay, that's interesting. I'm kind of surprised a little bit because there's only about, well, now the numbers are going up. It's taking a minute. I'd say over half the people on the call. So great. And hopefully I can share some things with you that'll help you do that a little bit more successfully. So, there's so much. So let me just locate my history as a facilitator. So I was trained as a mediator back in the late 80s at the Seattle Dispute Resolution Center, and I was trained in sort of, you know, very basic mediation negotiation techniques, and I did a lot of local kinds of issues when I was in Seattle. Then I was appointed as the director of alternative dispute resolution in Utah, and for 5 or 6 years I worked, well, it's even longer if you can, the private work that I did after, I was the director of dispute resolution. So my work was really to promulgate mediation programs, facilitation programs, and as part of that, I was involved for a number of years on a task force that was working on racial and ethnic fairness in our judiciary. And I was the lead facilitator on that initiative. And during that time, I led many, many conversations in different contexts related, these kinds of hard conversations related to things like religion, gender relation, race issues, ethnicity issues, anything where there's a kind of a polarity in the field that actually invites us to identify with the part of us that is ethnocentric. And for those of you who are on the call who are maybe new to Integral, we often use a developmental map to do our facilitator work. So when we think about just a very crude way of talking about human development, that we move from egocentric to ethnocentric, in which our group identity is primary, then we move to worldcentric, in which our identification with humanity is primary, and then if we're lucky, we might move to cosmic-centric, in which our identity to all existence is primary. So at egocentric, the self is primary. At ethnocentric, the group is primary. At world-centric, you could say the planet, humanity, is primary. And at cosmic-centric, existence itself is what we care about. So these kinds of conversations tend to draw out of us a very ethnocentric orientation. And some of us like to move beyond that ethnocentric orientation and not identify so much as a white American or an African American or a Euro-American or South American or Middle Easterner, just wherever our nationality or our religious background or our race is the primary identifying mark. And yet, it's so deep in human culture for us to create us and them. I'm here, you're there. We're safe, you're dangerous. That's so deep in our evolution that for us as integralists, having conversations that immediately acknowledge the difference between those two stages in development, and that when we, all of us, no matter how we see ourselves in any one moment, our primary identification can be with our group. And because of that, we can feel threatened, and we actually may belong to a group that has a long history of oppression by other groups, and we have to acknowledge the reality of that, right? Others of us may belong to majorities in which we've had the privilege of feeling safer, we've had more opportunity, whatever it happens to be. But each one of us, when we are identified with our group or we're having conversations about group, about the group, we're all going to experience the kind of fear and defensiveness and anger and outrage to some degree that comes along anytime you open up a conversation with these kinds of really fundamental polarities, black, white, right, wrong, good, bad. So I'm going to turn my attention now to talking about just the events in Ferguson for a moment, and then we're going to I'm going to receive just some opening comments from you, and then that will help me structure the conversation as we move along. So what happened in Ferguson, and my source for this is the New York Times. They have a web page that basically just kind of tries to lay out as best we can the kind of third-person objective perspective of what actually happened. So Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, was shot and killed Saturday, August 9th by Darren Wilson, a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis. The killing ignited more than a week of protest and has drawn outrage on social media like Twitter and Facebook. What do both sides say about how Michael Brown was killed? The circumstances of his death are in dispute. The police say that Mr. Brown was shot during a fight for the officer's gun, while other witnesses say that his hands were in the air when the last of several shots were fired. Accounts given to local and federal investigators by witnesses seem to agree this struggle began with Mr. Wilson and his patrol car. And I'm going to just skip to the fact that accounts differ. And, you know, at that point, you know, they're just
it starts to become a question of how do we establish most clearly what actually happened in this event. And of course, the ensuing outrage in Ferguson has been from the African-American community basically saying that here's another example of an unarmed, very young black male being, the victim of police brutality. And then that conversation about police brutality expands into one about the militarization of the police in America, which is another subject matter that comes up. There's also conversations about the bias of the media in this particular event, whether they have leanings towards supporting the view of race bias or away from it. Questions regarding the trust in the justice system, of course, come up because as soon as we turn it over to investigators, prosecutors, judges, and juries, then if you're a member of the black community, you probably don't have faith that that process is going to take care of itself. So obviously that comes up. Questions about what's going to happen. Some people demanding now the firing and the arrest of the officer. Lots of protests, lots of outrage, lots of media coverage, and lots of confusion. And so this is kind of where we're going to begin the conversation, is just to give that big overview and to name some of the strands that are happening in the conversation. But what I'd like to ask from you right now as you're listening is, right now, if I ask you the question, you know, what is most relevant to you in this moment about this conversation, I'd like just to pick out, you know, maybe 7 or 8 comments. And what I'd like you to do, just because we don't have all that much time, is just to kind of complete the sentence. What's most relevant to me about what's happening in Ferguson right now is, and just complete that sentence, do it in, you know, under a minute. And that way I can kind of see what's most alive for people on the call right now. And that will help me shape, you know, what topics we actually cover. And by the way, I also have a list of questions that people have sent in that are very good and very, very nuanced and very astute questions that I will weave throughout the call. So what is most relevant to you about this conversation right now? If you have something coming up, please press 1 on your handheld, and I'll take those comments before I start to outline how we're going to proceed. So I'd like to hear first from Sandra. Go ahead, Sandra.
It would be my empathy for the pain of personal loss and people feeling personally taken away from them without any power.
Absolutely. So empathy for the personal loss, for things taken away, and for the experience of, you didn't say disempowerment, but there's something about not having power or losing power. Okay, great. Very good. Laura, how about you?
I was shocked by the way the whole situation was handled by the police. Why was he allowed?
Yeah.
Why was he allowed to just sit out on the street, lie out on the street for 4 hours? It was like a lynching, and that's what I find is should be looked at, and it's upsetting.
Absolutely, upsetting in terms of your and it. I'm just going to say right now your perspective of what the police did, and because keeping in mind our media sources sometimes disagree about that, but yes, and that it, you know, it just feels like just old style racism and lynching, as you said.
Yep.
All right, Sharona, please, what is most relevant to you right now about this?
It's how to hold this situation in the largest possible context so that we can really discern some of the truth and bring society back into balance, at least in that corner, and maybe allow it to expand from there to just recreate balance and power and all that.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. So how do you create the large enough possible context to achieve the most balance for culture? Great. And I don't know quite how to say it, if it's Antoni or Antoine or Antoine Moore.
Yes.
Please.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
I can.
Yes, it's
can
Antoine. So I was just thinking about you began by establishing the facts, quote unquote, the facts, and I think that as people talk about what are the facts of the case, that Mm-hmm. That people, it sort of even happened on this call, people have slightly different takes about what was happening based on the views that they held already. So the facts are never just the facts. So how do you get to have a mutual conversation when the point of departure actually is coming from different places?
Yes. Well, one of the skills we can use, and I'm just going to say this right off the bat, everybody, just as you're listening, and then I'll go back to getting what's important to you. One of the things that we can do is establish the use of three perspectives, and this is one of the things that the integral map helps us do, is so that when we're in a third-person perspective, what we're basically doing is describing the facts to the best extent that we can based on what we know. And as we know, science is even creative and fluid, right? And let alone the court system and what they end up establishing as facts. So it's a third-person perspective, which is with as much certainty as we can get to, understanding there's never final certainty. Then we really want to base a lot of the conversation in our own first-person perspective, because once we move from third to first, then we can actually just hear where people are at and basically really, so, you know, really be sort of poised to listen really deeply without then sort of kind of drifting into third persons. Well, that isn't what happened. This is what happened. So moving from third person, this is the it that we're working with. It may not be absolutely true. This is what we know for right now. And then moving to first, what's your first person experience? And right now what I'm doing is I'm gathering comments with an emphasis in first person. And then lots of times by the end of the conversation, should it go well, and they don't always, as everyone knows, should it go well, we might actually be able to move into what we call the second person, in which we start speaking as we. And what's great about the second person in a conversation like this is it actually demonstrates that we've moved from third to first, where our feelings and our subjectivity and our values have come online and our differences. But when we move into a we, it can be an inclusive we that includes everybody on either side of where the conflicts are. So a we can be very useful to end the meeting on. So I would just ask you to kind of track those perspectives and see if that isn't helpful to you as we move through the call. A little bit of a ground rule, actually. So let's see. Mary, how about you? Mary Folger? I'm not hearing Mary. Let's give it one more shot. Mary, are you there? Okay, Simone, I'll take two more comments. Simone, what's relevant to you right now? What's important to you?
Hi. To me, I would be interested in seeing this as an example to draw out some principles for how to facilitate conversations like this where biases and discrimination are present,
yes,
and maybe in
yes.
the shadow or not.
Yes. Okay, great. Great. So in a certain way, what you're reiterating is really our purpose for this is to give you some kind of structures and maps that can help you move through these conversations. And then finally, let's hear from Judy.
Yeah. I guess the experience is sort of this deep sadness that for the police it's always a matter of that there aren't any other options. It's just violence
mm-hmm.
or killing.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually feel for both the police in that
mm-hmm.
and the community. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's some lack of imagination
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. that things could actually be different, approached differently.
Yeah, yeah. And now let me go back to our model for human development, how we move from ego to ethnocentric to world-centric to cosmic-centric. And a healthy development kind of anticipates that we transcend and we include those stages, meaning that when we move, let's say, from ethnocentric to world-centric, we start to care about the whole. We start to care about the police maybe at a different level than we might when we're ethnocentric, unless, of course, you're involved in law enforcement or more associated to the protection than to the outrage or the breach, if you will. So right now your comment is a world-centric comment. Like, how is it that I can include the whole? My advice to everybody on the call, the best way to include the whole is to be sure to include the perspectives that are ethnocentric, that are at an ethnocentric level of development. So you'll see this as we move through. If you'd like to maybe just get out a piece of paper, I'd like to just give you some general structures that I use that I find to be incredibly helpful. So just for a structure of this kind of conversation, here are some things that we should keep in mind. Keeping in mind, everybody, when you have people come to a conversation like this, they're going to, of course, you know, people want to act. People want something to be done, particularly where there is an injustice. But keep in mind that talking itself is practicing new actions. So I always like to encourage people and thank people for being in the conversation, because talking actually lays the groundwork for different kinds of activity, as we know. So you want to start by really thanking and encouraging people for that. The second thing is to be really, really clear about your purpose. So the purpose on the call today for me is to review some of what happened, but mainly to give you some tips and some cues about how it is that you can support these kinds of conversations, these more troubling and difficult and emotionally charged conversations that get right at the heart of who we think we are and our identities. How can you be more helpful as an informal listener, as a professional mediator? Right. So what's the intention of the conversation? Then you're going to want to move to whatever ground rules you have. So one of the ground rules that I want to establish is that we pay attention to what perspective we're coming from. If we're working in a third-person perspective, let's be clear that we're talking about as much as we can about objective reality. We're also spending most of our conversation in a first-person perspective, so we don't have to argue about truth and we can share perceptions. And then maybe we'll get to some kind of we. So really paying attention to perspective is a ground rule I'd like to put in place. The skill that I would really like to put in place is the skill of inquiry and of listening, like really just being willing to listen and see what it is that you can grow from. And as far as our call's concerned, I don't feel like we need any other ground rules besides those. But the container always helps to keep us, running smoothly. What's the structure of how we're going to work? And confidentiality is often a ground rule that's really necessary depending on what you're doing. So first of all, what we want to do is just simply pull out, you know, sort of the different threads of conversation that are playing. You know, so one is simply the facts conversation. What does it look like when we compare facts, and who's our sources for what actually happened, and what do we do when there's disagreement, as Antoine already asked us about? That's very important. What about when we disagree about what we call third person or objectivity? How is that handled? So that's something we'll look at. So there's the facts conversation. You know, where culture is right now, if you just look at the emotion that is being displayed, we have to build in some time for dealing with people's emotions. You know, conventionally, you know, we talk about it as venting, or we talk about it as, you know, people really getting their emotions out. But what happens in lots of groups is that there's no ground rule established around that, or it's not included as part of the map. So instead of saying, okay, for the next few minutes, we're just going to feel. We're going to feel the pain of this situation. We're going to feel the loss to this family and this young man's life. We're going to feel the absolute outrage that the Black community feels in St. Louis and should, with this long history of racism that people in the country have been experiencing. You know, notice what you're allowed to let into the room. Do you feel that, there's room for that grief? People tend to try to manage emotions without actually giving time for emotions to be expressed. So I always work to find the temperament of the group. How hot or how cold does a group want to run? And in a case like this, some of the town meetings that have been happening around Ferguson and St. Louis, for instance, it's run really, really, really hot. So if emotions are going to run heated and hot, you want to prepare your room for that. You know, this is going to be hot, okay? Nobody's going to be killed. Everything is safe and you know, God willing, and the creek don't rise. As a facilitator, anything outside of my understanding, and you can trust me to kind of work with the emotions in the room, but we're going to let some heat be expressed because people are upset. All right, so the emotions usually follow next in the conversation. Once you've established the facts, you really just want to get the quality that we've talked about already, the empathy that was expressed for the personal loss, the shock of how the police have behaved. And again, at this point, we're not arguing anything at all about what actually happened. So we're in the realm of perception, and if someone has an experience of empathy, it's allowed. If someone has an experience of shock, it's allowed. If someone has an experience of outrage, it's allowed. If someone has an experience of grief, it's allowed. If someone hears a shadow voice in these kinds of conversations, someone might have the experience. Let's just say if you're a white person in Ferguson, you might have an experience that you're getting blamed unfairly, right? Is there space for that? I would suggest there is. You know, someone feels like, I feel like I'm being attacked and I don't feel like I know what happened and I don't feel responsible. All right, we can let that in. I will say this, that where culture is in its development is going to some degree determine, you know, how much of anyone, you know, there's a little bit of a recipe here in terms of how much emotion we allow and what domain. And if the preponderance in the room is outrage and anger, then damn it, that's what needs to be expressed. But even to the extent that there's a fear about that anger, let's let it in. Even to the extent that there's some resentment about that, let's let that in. But really note that in terms of culture, right now, the outrage and anger deserves the biggest seat at the emotional table, at least in my view. But I want to let all those emotions on the table. So the next thing is to begin to sort through what is it that actually needs to be talked about. And as we've said here, we have one of the things you have to unpack is the way in which different subject matters kind of inform each other. It makes it really hard to navigate a conversation. So race and race profiling in this case, and the targeting of blacks by law enforcement, and the brutality, the brutal treatment of blacks by the police. You know, that's the biggest conversation here, right? But there are other conversations. There's the conversation of the change in law enforcement from, you might say, peace officers. Somebody sent in a question, which I will raise right now. Donna said that the British police call themselves a police service for keeping the peace. They're trained in negotiation, facilitation, and cross-cultural skills. Only special teams have weapons, batons. American police are a police force for maintaining law and order. And guns are less prevalent in the UK. But basically the question is, you know, what do we do in terms of the difference in the culture of law enforcement? And I will say that just in my own understanding, my studies, that the war on drugs and the war on terror have contributed in some ways to the militarization of local police force, because federal agencies are looking to local police to respond in more like a, you know, more like you're involved in a war than you're involved in keeping the peace, that you're there to serve and protect. So this whole thing about law enforcement being there to serve and protect or law enforcement being there to fight a war is a very big conversation that also needs to happen. It's a very important conversation, and there are big distinctions there. Of course, you know, we have to talk about the media's role in all this and the kind of bias in the media. We need to talk about the safety of law enforcement and what sort of, you know, just expressing the importance that any civil society must have a dependable law enforcement, and law enforcement itself needs to be protected. That's another dimension of the conversation. Then, you know, people's minds are going to turn to the trust in the justice system, where people are demanding the firing and the arrest of this officer. You know, how can we talk about the lack of faith in the justice system, particularly if you're an ethnic minority? Again, that's an area that I have quite a lot of experience in. So my suggestion to you would be, don't talk about all these things at once unless you're in a venting process. If you're in a venting or you're just wanting to get emotions out, go ahead and let all these things run into each other. But once you really want to start talking about it and really get listened to, it's very important as a facilitator or as a support person that you identify what part of the conversation we're actually in. And I'm going to pause right here because I'm saying a lot, being very highly aware of the time flow. And is there anybody who has a comment or a question about anything I've said so far? And maybe you can erase all the raised hands so we can start again. I'm doing my best to lay out some structures that can be helpful to you. Anything? Let's see, it looks like there's one. So this is Aaliyah. Go ahead, Aaliyah.
Hi. The structure is extremely useful. Thank you very much. And I wanted to say one thing about facts. I've noticed through my life that there's a it's not just whether we agree on the truth of the facts. People are often operating from different sets of facts because they have access to different sets of information, and each one assumes that the other one knows the same facts they do. They both might have entirely true and objective views of the facts, but they might actually have different sets of facts. And
yeah,
I find that really, really common.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Different sets of facts. And my husband used to be our Chief Justice on our Supreme Court. He wrote one of the cases that he wrote that took national prominence was the problem of eyewitnesses, right? So what happens is that eyewitness accounts turn out to be much, much, much less dependable than we used to think they are, right? So our source for getting accurate information about what really happened after the fact, so to speak, is very difficult in some ways because these things are happening lightning fast, and now in the time of, video cameras and whatnot, we're getting more kind of accurate records of things that are going on. But even then, sometimes those are subject to interpretation, and Anton made the comment earlier, and he's correct, that even if we have the same set of facts, we have a different interpretive frame. We have different enculturation. So if I'm from the white majority, the way I'm going to see what happened is necessarily different than if I'm a person of color living in Missouri. I mean, I live on a daily basis in an absolutely different world. And one of the main frustrations in this conversation, not just for Black Americans, but for white Americans as well, is the insistence by, people in general and by talk show hosts that the issue of racism has somehow been abated or it never really has existed for some people. Like, you have to persistently ask the majority to consider the daily and yearly impact of racism on your person and on your family and on your work life and on your economic status, just to feel that day in and day out, and just that you are absolutely, utterly shaped by that experience. And that's partly what a world-centric view or a postmodern view allows people to be able to do. So even though I don't identify as a person of color, I mean, I certainly as a woman have my views around, majority and minority politics, but I, as a person with world-centric consciousness, I can actually receive, and it's very important, when you move from ethnocentric to world-centric, your defensive posture around the group changes. So my defensive posture as an ego changes as I develop to ethnocentric and my group becomes my identification, right? Now we have that boundary around the group. Well, that boundary changes as you move to world-centric, and what world-centric allows you to do is listen to the perspective of people from different positions and actually take it in a way that you literally can't at ethnocentric. Now, keep in mind, world-centric includes healthy ethnocentrism, so I should be able to, as a white woman, listen to the experience of what it's like to be a person of color and just that absolute, fundamental and daily offense that people experience, and then also to sort of create a place for the ways in which culture has actually grown, and that we've outgrown some of our prejudices, and that we've actually made institutional changes that have made a difference. Are we finished? No. But I can hold that complexity, and at an ethnocentric level of development, holding that complexity is much, much more difficult. Things are much more black and white. So, Aaliyah, that was a long comment in relationship to your comment. I'm sorry. Are you there?
Oh, I put myself back on mute. It was good and useful. It's so often I find in a conversation that a person assumes that somebody else, the other person in the conversation, knows a certain fact or is aware of a certain fact, and it isn't that they would even disagree about it or that they would even have different interpretations. It's simply that one knows about it and assumes the other does, and the other isn't even aware of it.
Yeah, that's right. So there can be, anytime it, you know, it's a little difficult to facilitate. You know, I'd rather send people to the New York Times or read from the New York Times. I don't particularly like facilitating sharing the facts because it's hard to get people to agree on a third-person perspective. So I prefer to establish the facts, and if there's solid disagreements about that, I can allow for that. But I don't generally like negotiation on facts. I'd rather go to a third-person source and just use it for now, you know, understanding highly that people will have different information and people will also have different interpretations. All right, so now once we've actually established these different areas, and this is for you, then basically what we want to do is we want to pick up one or two of these topics or three, however many we're going to cover, and we really want to pick up the polarity. And we want to start with where the group is. So in this particular case, what I want to hear, let's just say we're going to start with race bias and racial profiling by law enforcement. I'm going to just hear about it. You know, as a facilitator, I want the room to hear about that, right? And that is going to be kind of the center of gravity around which the rest of the conversation is going to flow and really kind of let that get out. And there's always a nice automatic moment where you can talk about the opposite, right? So you get the main part of the polarity out, which is there is race bias, and now we have to somehow surface that there isn't, right? So we get this idea out that there isn't, or there wasn't in this situation, or the police generally do a good job, or and just kind of find some kind of relative truth around maybe not all situations have it. Can we in the room create a situation? You know, because the whole question is, how are we going to establish what actually happens here in terms of our culture? That comes a little bit at the end of the conversation. That has to do more with actions or initiatives that we're going to take related to this. So keep in mind, our purpose is to have conversation on this call. We're not necessarily going to create an initiative or an action. And an action can be a personal change. It can be, something like what I was involved in, the Task Force on Racial and Ethnic Fairness, which worked for 5 years together. So we're looking at this polarity, the polarity of, yes, there is race bias, and we're looking at its opposite, no, there isn't. And we're allowing the predominant view in the room to really have voice, and then we're listening to the disagreement. We're allowing a place for it, you know? And then what's going to happen, it's going to flip again. And then that voice is going to say, hey, but there's a lot more crime in neighborhoods of people of color, and the police have to, you know, the police, if they operate from bias, they do so with a reason, right? And the question kind of becomes, given your group, you know, is there a way to presence that, or does that just negate too much of what was said earlier? As a facilitator, what I want to do is make sure that my group knows it doesn't in any way negate what was said earlier, but rather reality is complex, and there may be some ways in which that truth has to get into the room. And I'm not going to debate it. We're not going to debate it. That's not what we're here to do. We're here to exchange perceptions. We're here to listen. We're here to feel. And if there's an action we're going to take together, we'll take that action. And then the final flip is, so there is racism, there isn't racism. Well, the racism is there for a reason, right? And then the flip, finally, the fourth position is probably going to get mentioned as well, you know, which is, let me think it through here. So in some ways, at this point, what's important to me is to start to weave the group into being able to identify with their experience of outrage, the entire group, and then their experience of wanting change. Wanting change is where we start to kind of move into what happens with actions and what happens with initiatives. But I've got to think through my polarity so I can explain this a little bit. So, okay, so we just have two that are really important for us to work with. And one, of course, has to do with whether or not there's unfair treatment and whether there's injustice. So we have injustice and not injustice, and we also have what the experience of the black community is vis-a-vis law enforcement.
So we can also work with that. We may want to get some police perspectives pulled forward, allow some space in the room for that. And this is always where it's most dicey for facilitators, is because people, if you allow another perspective in, there's the idea that that perspective in some way will discount what was said earlier. I think the main job you can do in these kinds of conversations is to really assert that there's space for perspectives, and there's also, you know, an abundance of truth, and that we can actually make these distinctions. So I'm wondering, I'm hoping I did a good enough job with that. Please raise your hands if you have a question or a comment about the idea of dealing with the polarity and then letting it slip. Almost always you can get agreement at this stage of a conversation, particularly if you've allowed the emotional expression to really be received and listened to properly. The question is, who would like to see change? My guess would be when that question is posed, you're going to get pretty close to 100% of the people in the room. So when you pose that question takes you out of the dialogue, out of the looking at two sides of an argument or two sides of an experience, and now what are we going to do together? And, you know, if it isn't a group that comes together because they are going to do an initiative or they're going to demand something of the police force or they're going to work with the justice system, you know, you can always have people take the action of making a personal commitment. You know, so in this case, you can ask people to make a personal commitment to, if you are facilitating this conversation, to becoming more deeply aware of bias. And I want to just look at a participant's question who says this, she's asking about whether or not, actually there are two of these, you know, where can a person of Euro-American descent or white contribute to these conversations, or does it detract? Are people able to show up? And my suggestion would be to work in teams. I think it's easy, but it just depends on how willing you are to do the work you need to do to understand all the points of view, and how willing you are to sometimes be challenged with the fact that there might be something you're not seeing. And I find that as a facilitator, one of the ways I grow is by noticing when I can't see what it is people are trying to show me in any kind of a discussion. And so if you really do your homework, if you really know how to take multiple perspectives, if you know how to hold a room, if you're fearless, and if you're willing to grow, then you should get in there and do it, is what my answer to that question is. Anton says that some people don't understand systems like systemic racism, how to raise the issue about restructuring and accountability with people who can't even see what you're talking about. Well, and I think, you know, all of us learn through being educated, and all of us learn through relationships. So if my challenge is to work with people around the difference between, you know, sort of the interiors of race bias and the exterior structures, the best way to do that is to talk about an example, you know. So on a personal example, you could say something like, you know, an African-American judge on the bench in Utah, every time he goes into a 7-Eleven, he's followed, right? How many people in this room does that happen to, her or white? Zero, right? Now, what happens when we move from the individual incident and we move to the fact that the police are conditioned to follow black people, the prosecutors are conditioned to prosecute black people, right? The judges and juries tend to hand out harsher sentences to people of color, and our jails are overcrowded in terms of the percentages. Now we're talking about institutional racism and its impact. So the most we can do is educate and have conversations on that specific topic so that people, even against their will, sometimes get educated. Just another question that I want to take that I think is a good one is, well, there's so many good questions. Let's see. Shouldn't the discussion be about police brutality as a whole? I would say that it should, because if you talk about police brutality as a whole, then you're going to, you know, there'll be a cross-cultural weave. Now, the question is, how do you do it in such a way that the police are actually willing to listen?
And that becomes the challenge of that conversation, is including the police and doing it in a way that the leadership of the police want to make change. So that's where your challenge is going to be when you do that. And so that's kind of the, because I notice we're running out of time, I just want to give, if look and see if anybody has any kind of desperate question that they want to ask just before we end. I know I covered so much. Any question that would be really helpful to you if I would address it? All right, Rebecca. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for taking that journey with me. Always end your meetings with an appreciation, you know, just that people have taken the time to learn and that they've been moved out of their comfort zones and they've been willing to take other perspectives, and remind them again that talking creates new grooves and gives us a platform for new actions. So thank you very much for being on the call. I really appreciate it. Bye, everybody. Becky?
Have and your response to that, but also outlining so clearly the actual steps that someone can follow and be mindful of when entering into these conversations. And I'm just so encouraged in hearing the kind of questions that we've had this morning, that people are ready and willing and already having conversations like this to bridge perspectives and build community around what we all care about and the kind of changes that we all hope to see. So I really appreciate everyone for that. And again, thank you, Diane, for your teaching. For anyone that does not know, Diane has was recently published through Shambhala Publishing, and her book is called Everything is Workable, A Zen Approach to Conflict Resolution. If you haven't read it, it's a very it's a beautiful book, very practical, touching stories, great examples, and really a guide for everyone, I think, in having healthier relationship to conflict. And I can't recommend it strongly enough. So I'd like to thank everyone for joining us for this little conversation and kind of opening the box and how we can have these hard conversations, and invite anyone who's interested to learn more about how you can work with Diane and the other faculty members in any of our integral facilitator programs to stay on the call. And I do want to let you know that we will be sending you a link to an audio from today's call, which you can enjoy at your convenience. And please feel free to share it if it serves. And we will be sending out another notice for another call some point in the near future, usually about every 6 weeks or so. We invite people in for a little taste of an integral view of how we can work more productively and with more compassion in culture. So thanks again, and I'll invite everyone to stay on the line that might want to ask questions or hear more about the programs.